This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk.
Like, when I quit my job in finance, I kind of had to, like, check my identity. I had to, like, find a new life. I had to, like, work out, like, what am I doing now? How am I going to contribute? How am I going to make myself useful? How am I going to find structure? Sort of after that life had come to an end. And, you know, in a sense, there's an analogy there with, like, quitting drinking. You do have to some extent, like, change your life, change some of your friends, change your habits, change some of your hobbies. You have to be able to change your identity to some extent.
We've got a really interesting guest for you this week on Over the Influence. And we discussed something that I don't think in the 5 years that we've been doing this has ever cropped up before on the podcast. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You're going to have to keep listening. So today's guest, as you heard there, he is called Barney Whiter, based in Surrey, being alcohol-free for more than 1,000 days. In fact, at the time of recording, 1,025 days. Barney is a financial expert, was able to retire at the age of 40. I'll stop talking, let Barney do the explaining, and let's get into this week's episode.
Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, my name's Helen, and I'm 10 years alcohol-free this year. I joined Over the Influence 4 years after I'd stopped drinking, and I expected it was going to be a place where I could talk anonymously about my shameful secret. But what I actually got transformed me and really surprised me. I spent hours talking to like-minded people all over the world on Zooms about our wins and our struggles, and realised being alcohol-free was something to be proud of, not be ashamed of. And then I became a Zoom host myself, and I love every call, which is different and fascinating. I got amazing advice on the forums when I was struggling, and giving advice to others on the forums reminded me why I stopped drinking. I went on outdoor adventures at mountains, and I met people in real life who I feel like I've known forever, and I've had the most amazing deep conversations with them. I found actual real life friends and a brilliant supportive community of like-minded people, all shouting the benefits of being alcohol free. Now I'm happy to talk to anyone I know about how I'm gloriously alcohol free and how much I gained by giving up one thing. If you have a voice in your head wondering if you should rethink your relationship with alcohol, then you probably should, and Over the Influence is an excellent place to start. I wish I'd had Over the Influence when I first stopped drinking, but I'm so grateful. It's a big part of my life now, which I wouldn't be without.
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to this week's episode of Over the Influence. It is marvellous to have you listening. It's going to be a good episode today. I can sense it already. My name is Sharon Hartley. I'm based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. This year, I will be 7 whole years alcohol-free. Flipping heck, who'd have thought it? And if you are one of the subscribers to our premium podcast, I'll share a little bit more about what the weekend just like has been for me. And it's just been one filled with joy, filled with really nice stuff. And I think that's one of the things we worry about an awful lot at the beginning when we decide to either take a break or remove alcohol completely from our lives. It's been dead good. It's been really nice. And I sometimes think, why didn't I do this sooner? Anyway, 51 years old, 3 kids, a dog and a tortoise, 1 husband. And it was only ever meant to be a break. I think it's really important to keep reminding people of that. You know, I didn't all of a sudden go one day, right, I'm going to stop drinking now and change my life. It's been quite the flipping journey, but it continues. Hands down, the best thing I ever did, slap bang in the middle of my 40s. And as always, it's great to have you listening. Thank you kindly. Ben Anderson, how are you?
Hi.
Co-host,
yeah.
Producer.
Hi.
General Dog's Body. What else?
Hi. Well, I like to say co-founder. We did talk, it was a few weeks ago where it was awkward,
yeah,
wasn't it? Where you, you'd
that.
Done an interview,
yeah,
where you were the founder of Over the Influence.
Never
remember that?
Said that.
Do you remember that?
No.
No, it's fine.
I corrected somebody.
Yeah.
That said that.
Fine. Yeah, fine. Yeah. Okay.
Just remember that.
The line. We're sticking to it. I'm Ben. Yeah. I'm 36. I live in Liverpool. I am dad to baby Leo. I am stepdad to Alfie and Millie. I'm husband to Jem. I run radio stations by day and podcast about alcohol-free life by night.
You don't do it by night. You're lying because you're too knackered. You also do that in the day as well because you're alcohol-free.
Sometimes. Yes, a very important meeting in the side room. I'm talking to Sharon. That never happens. Look, this is public. Our bosses do listen to this. But look, I gave up alcohol 5 years ago next month, and it was only supposed to be a break. Like Shaz, I said 3 months because I drank a lot over the COVID period, you know, those first few months, really ramped up my drinking. I suppose in my 20s, I drank and it was fun. In my 30s, I started noticing that I was drinking because I was feeling stressed. I'd be at home. I'd go, why am I 4 cans in? There's no one else here. Removing alcohol for me wasn't supposed to be forever. It was 3 months. And then I got to 3 and went, this feels good. Let's try 6. Got to 6, went, oh, why not say, wouldn't it be cool to say that I had 12 months off alcohol? But then I got to 12 months and day 366, and I went, right, I don't want to drink again, because looking back at the changes that I've seen over a year.
The data.
But you can't ignore that. You can't.
But it's such a huge thing. I
would have been an idiot. If I decided to go back to drinking, I would have been an idiot because everything had improved in that year.
Yeah.
And yeah, 5 years next month. Can't believe it.
That's half a decade, Ben.
It is.
Like in the blink of an eye. That is amazing, isn't it?
I've got one more thing for my intro. This will become relevant soon. As we record today, I will be 40 in 1,111 days. It's quite
I can't believe you've done this. Yeah. I can't believe you've worked
1,111 days left,
right,
to get this sorted.
Hold that thought.
That will become relevant.
Hold that thought. Ben, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed that introduction. Let's get to today's guest. He is called Barney Whiter. He is based in Farnham in Surrey. Barnum. Who the friggin' hell's Barnum?
That's a circus. Barnum the circus.
It's
P.T. Barnum. This is the greatest show.
You mean Barney from Farnham?
I've joined the circus. I've joined the circus here.
You certainly have. Did come in on this podcast. Let me tell you,
exactly.
Barney. Oh, that is brilliant. That's a mixture of Barney, who is from Farnham. Right, I'll shut up. Barney Whiter, financial expert. It's fabulous to have you here. Welcome to the chaos that is Over the Influence. First question, how the heck are you doing? How's your day been?
I'm great. I've always wanted to join the circus, and now I'm here.
And now you are here, invited guest. Barney, before we started with recording, I asked you the question, how long have you been alcohol-free, sober, teetotal, however you want to describe it? More than 1,000 days. That's a flipping big number, isn't it? How does that feel?
No, it's great. It's 1,025. I mean, I'm a little bit embarrassed that it took me so long, if I'm honest. You know, because I only started that when I was 52. So I had like a 35-year drinking career from age 17 to 52. So that's like 35 years. So I'm a slow learner.
Why do you feel embarrassed about that? You should feel really proud.
It's just like, I just look back now and think, there's so much time in my life that I was either hungover or like not fully present. And like not getting that back, so I wish I'd come to it sooner, but we are where we are. You can't change the past. This is where we are.
Why do you think that so many of us, and I'm referring here to a lot of people that listen to the podcast, we've got members of our community, guests that we've had on the podcast, leave it so long when that seed can be planted about cutting down, knowing that there's an issue? Why do you think that we leave it so long? I was 44 when I started doing this. And, you know, Ben knows this. Ben was in his early 30s when he started, and I thought that was brilliant. And anybody...
That is brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, any age, you know, 18 onwards, if you're choosing to make that decision, I just think it is absolutely phenomenal because you save yourself, you know, potentially decades of pain.
Yeah.
Why do you think we sometimes wait that long?
I don't know about other people. All I can speak for is... why I was a slow learner. And look, I needed like a compelling reason. I needed to hit a brick wall. I needed to get to a point where I had no choice. So during COVID, which Ben mentioned, I had in the sort of lockdowns after, I had two big health scares in pretty quick succession. So within 1 year, I had two separate things happen. So firstly, I had this condition called like Barrett's esophagus, which is inflammation of the esophageal lining and stomach and esophageal lining. Had a very unpleasant experience with an endoscopy where you go to hospital and they put a tube like down your throat and they like your gag reflex is engaged. Oh. And you like, but you can't like gag out the tube, and they put the camera down inside. You can feel it like waggling around in your esophagus, and you can see the pictures on the TV. And that was a brutal, like an unpleasant experience. And the condition Barrett's esophagus is essentially inflammation of the lining, and they just told me, you know, your odds of developing esophageal cancer are like whatever it was, like 25% over the next few years. And so I'm like, hello, like that doesn't sound good. Nothing about that sounds good. And so I obviously asked, you know, what causes that? What can I do about that? And they said, well, like one of the main causes is, you know, is alcohol. And, you know, I didn't want to hear that because alcohol was fun for me. It was a treat for me. I thought it was a reward. It was my sort of way of patting myself on the back for whatever that, you know, working or like doing what I was supposed to do. And so I really identified alcohol as my reward. So I needed to be shocked. And so firstly, I have this endoscopy. And then the second thing that happened also in the year after COVID, I just totally lost my libido, just totally lost all interest in any of that stuff. I could have like walked through a room of like naked supermodels and I'd be like, where's the beer? Where's the bar? You know? And, those two things happening in quick succession kind of woke me up out of my stupor, woke me up out of my daze and set me off on some serious like health research rabbit holing on the internet.
What did you find? What did the internet tell you?
So I essentially read every book about men's health, health in general, longevity. I watched all the Huberman Lab podcast episodes. I mean, he did a very sort of well-known one about alcohol, mm-hmm. and that he didn't really pull any punches with that episode. You know, that I think that reached a lot of people. And eventually I was just learning more and more about the health impacts of alcohol. But eventually what I was struggling with was a book that linked that to libido. And eventually I found a book called, well, firstly, I found the book called The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober.
One of our
first book I read. First yeah. book I read in sobriety. Brilliant.
And it's a horror show, isn't it? I mean, it's a hell of a read. Like that, you know, that lady went on a real journey and she like damn near killed herself.
Yeah.
And got herself into all sorts of like terrible situations and scrapes and like just going, you know, going off with like random drinking buddies into the night and like how she survived that. So that made a big impression on me, that book. And it was incredibly honest. It's one of the things I noticed when I started reading these books, sort of quit lit books, like how incredibly honest people in this world are.
Yeah.
And they just sort of share what they've been through and what they've experienced. Anyway, in that book, she recommended another book called The Biology of Desire by a guy called Mark Lewis. And Mark Lewis is a very interesting guy. He is a neuroscientist and professor and academic and researcher, but also, and he studies the brain. And he's studied the dopamine system, and he studied, you know, how the brain, the role that sort of brain neurochemistry plays in addiction. But also in his youth, he himself was a heroin addict. And so it's very unusual. There's plenty of sort of scientists in this world. There's plenty of people that have been addicts in this world, but it's rare to find like a neuroscientist who had so much kind of skin in the game and so much personal understanding of addiction. Anyway, wrote this brilliant book, highly recommend it to, or I recommend to people all the time, called The Biology of Desire. And that book explains how addiction works. It explains how it essentially hijacks the dopamine system, how progressively you get more and more of your dopamine from the behavior or the substance that you are addicted to. And that essentially crowds out other pleasures in life. And so this is, he just explained so clearly for me the process of accelerated learning by which you form these habits, by which you, and essentially addiction is a habit. And it's something you have to learn. Your brain learns over time as you repeat the behavior. And essentially, as you develop that habit, as you develop that addiction, progressively, you get more and more of your dopamine from alcohol, if that's your problem. And the things that used to bring joy in the rest of your life, like, you know, maybe your family, your children, your work, your friends, your hobbies, essentially that gives you less and less dopamine. And so that is how addiction works and progresses, and how, if you like, the rut that you're in gets deeper and deeper over time. And so, and he said, and that's why heroin addicts lose interest, you know, lose interest in their partner, they lose interest in sex. And that was where it was spelled out for me. And I'm like, oh, okay, now I understand. I just need to quit alcohol, and then hopefully that will heal itself.
I want to know what life looked like for you more than 1,025 days ago. You were saying that you were sort of almost waiting for a brick wall, I think you described it as. Obviously, you've talked through the health issues then. We'll come on to what life's like now, you know, again, 1,025 days on, a little bit later on in the episode. But what was life like for you prior to that point, before you stopped?
So life was good. I did not consider myself an alcoholic. I absolutely did not consider myself an alcoholic. I did a month off alcohol, and I thought I'd done really well because I'd managed to do. I mean, to be, I only did February, like, and I chose February because it was like 28 days. Yeah, and I made sure it wasn't a leap year as well. So I'm like, I can't be an alcoholic because I've done 28 days without alcohol. I didn't drink every day. What I did was drink, you know, mostly on the weekend. I just could never do moderation. I just could not do moderation. And so, I would typically, drink on 2 days a week, but I could never just have one glass and be sensible. I'm like, well, what's the point of that? Are we doing this properly or not? And yeah. I'm a little bit like that in everything I do. It's like, are we doing this properly or not? And so it's really interesting for me as I, again, read some of these, the sort of quit lit books, like the Annie Grace book, The Naked Mind, was very good on this subject. She said, like, if you're a sort of hardworking person, it just, in some ways, it just makes you a better drinker because, you know, you're more, capable of drinking a lot and then like grinding through it and getting up the next day and going to work. And so everyone has their own kind of drinking style. And my style was essentially, I don't do moderation. And so I was prone to kind of binge drinking.
Me
and
too.
Then just powering on. Yeah. And when I was younger, I always thought, what I thought is that I can burn off the damage. So I can work hard, play hard, I can drink hard, and then I can exercise hard. So my mental model was, I will drink this bottle of wine or whatever, and then, you know, tomorrow or the next day or whatever, I'll go for a run, I'll go for a bike ride, and I will burn it off. And I just assumed that that would somehow reverse the damage. Mm. and you can burn off the calories, you can expend the energy, but you're absolutely not reversing the toxin, you're not reversing the poison, you're not reversing the damage to your brain.
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, physically you can undo some of the nastiness, I suppose, like you say, like the calories or whatever, but in terms of mental health, you can do pretty much bugger all about that.
Yeah, so I wasn't over alcohol didn't make me overweight, because I'm like, I'm burning off those excess calories, but it is poison. And that was one of the big reframes. That's one of the big changes. I just had to realize, oh, I'm drinking poison. Why would I poison myself? Why would I do that to myself? And it's kind of hilarious. Like, I did that for 35 years. And it never kind of crossed my mind that, like, what else is alcohol used for? So it's used for, like, sterilizing medical equipment, and it's used for people splash alcohol on cuts because they want to sterilize the wound and kill any germs and kill any bacteria. The other thing people, you know, use alcohol for is they, you know, like bioethanol. You can run a car, or you can burn it and run a car off it. And it's like, oh, right, so I'm kind of drinking petrol.
Yeah.
Reframing is such an important word in this whole thing, isn't it? Because when you were talking about moderation, then I was nodding along. I can't moderate either. But then for me, a kind of a reframe moment on that, it went from a kind of, oh, you idiot, why can't you moderate? Everyone else can moderate, and you can't moderate your alcohol. You go out and you binge drink. And you went, like, why can't you just do it? Like, why can't you just do what Jem does, my wife? Why can't you just have a glass of wine and leave it there? Why have you got to have the bottle? There's something wrong with you. But actually then, I had a moment where, I can't remember what it even was. It must be a conversation. It may have even been one of these podcasts with Sharon, potentially. I've been doing it for a very long time now. But the reframe moment for me was exactly what you said, is that actually, I can't moderate anything. And both stuff that's bad for me, and stuff that's good for me. Like, for example, my son is 2.5 years old, and I want to be the best dad ever. And I like throw my full self into being a dad. At work, you know, like, when I've got the bit between my teeth, we're doing it, you know, and it doesn't matter how difficult it is to get there, how painful it might be at parts. If we said we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And there's no doubt, I can't moderate that. Actually, not being able to moderate, being an all or nothing person, can sometimes be a really positive, really good thing, you know? And I think that kind of the reframing there is massively important. You know, this podcast, we're always talking about the very honest, as you said, the space is quite an honest space. It's an interesting, I've not thought about that before, actually. It's an interesting observation, how honest everybody is, warts and all, isn't it, I suppose, when you're looking back. But, you know, for us, it's, you know, we, speaking about the rock bottom thing, again, the power of the mind in these situations. You don't need to wait for a rock bottom to decide to remove alcohol. That's one of our big messages here. Why wait for that? Like, if you feel like you're going, it's going one way, then why wait? Why wait to feel great, Sharon?
That was
Oh, yeah. But reframe, the power of the mind in these situations is massively important. Barney, when you were talking, I feel like you are quite an analytical person. We should move on soon to, you know, the 1,111 days until I'm 40, because that has got relevance. But did you have to kind of, do you think that reading your way around this, was that the learning part of it, the education part of it, was that an important part of it for you?
Hugely important. So I did a ton of research. So I just found all the best books in the space. So I read, you know, like Alcohol Explained and This Naked Mind and The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober and The Biology of Desire. And, you know, I just found all the, like, as many of the sort of classic books as I could. I found the Huberman Lab podcast. Mm-hmm. I listened to his episode. I remember it very well, with Dr. Anna Lemke, who's an addiction specialist at Stanford. And what she explained is that essentially it takes about 30, 31 days to get a clean system through your, like, your dopamine system to normalize and for you to return to sort of base level. And so what I realized listening, doing that reading, listening to that podcast, is that when in the past I'd done my sober February, my month off, I had only just done like 28 days. And so I'm only just getting to the point where I've got a clean system. Like I've only just getting to the point where the fog has fully lifted. And I knew at the time I felt great, but what did I do? Because I'm an idiot. What do I do to celebrate 28 days of sobriety? Well, the same way I celebrated everything. It's like, well, I've earned my drink. And what I realized by that, through that learning process, is essentially once you've done 31 days, you've kind of cracked it. Like you're kind of through the worst. And I think one of the reasons that I was so slow to make the change is, for me, it always just seemed like the idea of giving up forever was intolerable. Like forever was too long. When you've made alcohol your reward and your treat and your motivation, giving up forever just seems like an impossible length of time. But finding the Human Lab interview with Anna Lemke, essentially it's like, oh, you just have to do 31 days and then your system is clean, the cravings fade, and the biology of desire essentially taught me that you will normalize. And so it might take you a month, it might take you 3 months, it might take you 6 months, but you will normalize. And I'm like, oh, I just have to get through 31 days. And then I just have to get through 90 days. And then once you're through 90 days, you're like, why was that ever such a big deal?
I know, but 31 days is a long time when you're on day one, isn't it?
It's a long time when you're on day one. It just seems, it seems crazy, crazy far away. So I just want to sort of tell people who essentially feel that it's impossible. Like you only have to do 31 days and the spell is broken.
How often do we say, Ben, on the Zoom calls in the community through our own experiences, talking about quit late, and there's a really good book out written by Sharon Hartley. Hi, Barney. The life-changing magic
of
quitting alcohol.
Fantastic.
But in that, the one thing I focus on, we talk about this a lot in Over the Influence as well, is that 100 days, triple figures, the tipping point. Like you say, get through that month, that 31 days, and it can be absolutely freaking torturous. You know, it can be so, so difficult, but then double it and you're at 60, you're at 2 months. Get to 3 months and beyond, triple figures. You know, we do say that it's life-changing. I've yet to meet a single person, and within this community, that's been going 4 years, the podcast has been going 5 years, we've spoken, I reckon, probably to thousands of people. You know, I've yet to meet one that has reached 100 days and God, I hated it, it was rubbish. You know, it does change and it does get better. What I want to come back to is what you were talking about before. It was really interesting talking about how addiction works and how it impacts on your other joys in life, whatever they may be. When you first started doing that then, in this, well, you know, use the 31 days, how did you get your dopamine hit? Like what were you replacing the alcohol with, if anything? Where did your buzz come from?
Yes, so essentially you sit below baseline for 31 days. So essentially life just feels a little grayer, a little like you're a little tetchier. And to Ben's point, I remember when alcohol would make me tetchy with the kids. Like, so I've got, like you, I've got three kids, and all throughout most of that time, you know, I was drinking, and I always noticed a big difference in, you know, a hangover day, I would just have a shorter temper, and I was just like less patient and less calm, and I was just a better person without alcohol. So, you know, the 31 days, you're still clearing your system. You're just, it's just life's just a little grayer, a little less crack, a little less sparkle, a little less fizz, you know, and it slowly normalizes.
Yeah.
So what I had to do was just make sure that in that first 31 days, I just removed the cues and the triggers and the things that reminded me of alcohol. So in the first 31 days, I did not go to the pub. You know, it basically took me 90 days before I was able to go to the pub and drink like non-alcoholic stuff with friends, because just the power of walking into a pub and seeing the optics and the lights and the sort of shiny setup, it just triggers all your accumulated kind of memory bank, if you like, of experiences with alcohol. So essentially, yeah, like life just felt a little sort of grayer in the recovery zone. But if you just know that it's finite and that you have these milestones, it's like, as you say, 36, there's some magic about 30, 60, 90, and then a year, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
If you know that you're just, then you're bridging the gap, and that like, it doesn't feel like it's unachievable and unbridgeable.
Ben, you're itching with numbers. Explain.
Well, look, I think we have, are we in the thousands now? We're definitely into the hundreds of hours of conversations that we've had on this podcast now. We started it back in March 2020. We've released them every week for the last 3 years. There's a lot of hours of conversations about alcohol-free life. I'd like to have a conversation that we've never had on this podcast before, Varney. I'd like to talk about money. And in your bio that you sent through to us, I'd like to talk about the impact that money has on addiction. The reason that I keep talking about it's 1,111 days, 1111, until I'm 40, is because you famously were able to retire at 40 because you're a financial expert. Should we start there in terms of how you were able to retire at 40, Barney? There's a lot of people going, bloody Barney, 40, bastard. That's what they're thinking now. but how were you able to retire at 40, Barney?
So I just was, I got, when I was 11, so this is the origin story, like you trace it back to a childhood experience, right? When I was 11, it was 1981 and interest rates went to 17%. And like my parents had done the classic thing that year of buy the biggest house and borrow as much money as the bank would lend to them. And so they'd stretch themselves, they bought the house, and then suddenly like interest rates spike up to 17%, and they were kind of screwed. And so they had to cancel the newspaper. My dad had to stop buying beer, and he brewed his own beer. We couldn't go on holiday. And so the whole household had to go on economy drive. And you know, it was no big deal. Like, you know, many, many people have been through much more significant hardship than that. It was nothing. But in my, you know, my childish sort of mind, I picked up on the anxiety that my parents were radiating. Like my mother at the time was very anxious about it. And that just left a deep kind of mark on me, which is that ultimately, if you borrow too much money and you can't pay the bank back, ultimately that, you know, you can lose your house. And that experience, I then overreacted against that. And so from that point onwards, I'm like, I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to do a degree in economics. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to train as a chartered accountant. I'm then going to work in corporate finance. I'm going to master this whole money thing. I'm going to learn to invest. I'm going to save as much as I can, invest as much as I can. And I'm going to build up a freedom fund to make myself like as financially secure as possible. And so that's what I ended up doing. So I essentially channeled childhood fear of homelessness and poverty and just kind of said, okay, well, I'm just gonna learn the money game.
I had a freedom fund. Well, I say my freedom fund was spent on freedom IPA rather than, you know, into the bank. It wasn't in an ISA, it was in an IPA instead, because I spent my Freedom Fund. Okay, so, you know, you obviously, you mastered money at a very early age. You're able to retire at 40. This bit here in the bio, Barney can talk to you about the link between money and drinking, the impact that money had on addiction. That's a conversation we've not had before on this podcast.
So essentially what I was doing was kind of channeling my motivation from that experience, channeling fear, and I was doing a job that was... It is essentially not what I want. It was not necessarily like what's my heart's desire, but like that's where the money was. It's like the old sort of joke about the bank robber. Like, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. And like, why did I work in finance? Why did I work in the city? Well, that was where you could make most money back in the 90s. And so I did that, but I was always kind of, you know, I was always like suppressing something, and essentially I used alcohol as my reward at the end of the week for enduring, you know, stress at work, conflict at work. I worked in, you know, on transactions where essentially there was always conflict was guaranteed, because like you've got a buyer and a seller and they're arguing about things and they're negotiating contracts and they're people are like threatening to walk away from deals, etc. So it was an environment where you were working under time pressure, demanding work, quite a lot of stress. And so alcohol was a way of winding down at the end of the week, rewarding yourself for like enduring another week, and essentially kind of numbing the pain in your soul if you're not on doing what you really wanted to do.
Funny, isn't it? Because, you know, that whole park bench thing, you know, scraggy hair, scruffy clothes, park bench. I've just been, while you were talking then, just Googling, trying to remember where it was from. And it's a stat from the NHS, NHS England Digital. The proportion of men and women who reported drinking over 14 units of alcohol weekly increased with household income. Among men, the highest proportion of those who drank 14 or more units a week was in the highest income households.
Yes.
It kind of makes more, you know, if you've got more money, you can spend more of it on booze.
Absolutely. So I remember once walking down my street, and what they'd done is they'd brought in recycling, and they brought in these recycling baskets. And so on whatever it was, Wednesdays or Thursday mornings, as you're walking to the train station, everyone's got their empties out. And in these sort of open top sort of plastic trays, I'm walking down my road, not lovely, lovely road, nice houses. I'm looking at everyone's bottles and I'm like, oh my goodness, like these, like everyone's at it. Everyone is at it. Like the number of cans and the number of, you know, I'm looking at the number of bottles, the number of cans, and I'm looking at the house and like working out how many people live there and doing the maths in my head. And I'm like, crikey, this is like an epidemic. You know?
Yeah. And how many of those people, if that was me, see, I would have gone down with my plastic bag and I'll go, put that bottle in that one. I'll put that bottle in that one. And that can go into number 34, and that can go into number 36.
Yeah, but there's nothing quite like, is there, these days when the recycling comes. I don't know about you, but I sort of like, I look around the street, is anyone looking at this? Look, it's just water bottles, it's fairy liquid bottles, you know, there's nothing rattles in there anymore, it's just plastic.
And nothing to see here, nothing to see here.
Nothing to see, look, I mean, look what I did, look what I did.
Well, the funny thing was, the council, a couple of years after, having just bought all these new trays, they replaced it all with bins with a cover. And I'm like, I wonder if that's because like everyone didn't like people seeing how much they were drinking.
Yeah, interesting. And I wonder, interesting point, isn't it?
If all the residents essentially complain, can we have a cut? Can we cover up our bottles, please?
Would you like a bin fact from where I live up in Liverpool?
Yes. Yes.
So we have purple bins here in Liverpool. Chaz, do you know why we've got purple bins? Famously, we've got purple bins here in Liverpool.
Nope.
It's because football is so important to everyone here. you couldn't have a blue bin. You couldn't have a red bin.
No red or blue.
You had to have a purple bin.
My word.
I love that. That's one of my favourite things about living here, is that I've got a purple bin. Anyway, sorry, Karen, back to you.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the clock. I'm aware we've probably got about 5 minutes left, Barney. So being able to retire at the age of 40, you know, that in itself is an incredible achievement. So obviously, even with the drinking, you were still doing well in, you know, in professional life. We talk so much about, no matter where you are in life, whatever your job, whatever your income, remove alcohol and things do start to get so much better. You know, you don't have to measure your success in how you're earning. It could be that you've got that job done, you've tackled that cupboard, you started reading, you know, whatever, things like that. How has removing alcohol more than 1,000 days for you then impacted on what sounds like an already very successful career?
Well, yes and no. So, I mean, I did what I did. I'm not sure it's the best, you know, I'm not sure it's the best idea to, like, quit without a good plan of what you're going to do next. Because certainly in my case, there was an element of the devil made work for idle hands. And so the habits, the drinking habits that I had picked up when I was holding down a demanding job, I continued those drinking habits when I didn't have a demanding job. And essentially that, you know, a habit that had some function and some utility, like the drinking habit, it had played a role. You know, there's one of the interesting things about addiction and alcoholism. Although it's obviously a huge net negative, there's always some useful function that it is performing, because no one's so dumb that they don't realize that it's bad for you, right? So the useful function that alcohol was performing for me was that it was, you know, a numbing mechanism, a coping mechanism, a reward mechanism. And I knew that I was in sort of health overdraft when I was sort of working long hours. And so I quit my job, but with hindsight, I would have been better trying to find some sort of form of working moderation, you know, because I don't do moderation in drinking, but essentially I went from a full on job to nothing sort of overnight. And that's quite a hard transition to make. So you know, you have to, like, when I quit my job in finance, I kind of had to like check my identity. I had to like find a new life. I had to like work out, like, what am I doing now? How am I going to contribute? How am I going to make myself useful? How am I going to find structure sort of, after that life had come to an end? And, you know, in a sense, there's an analogy there with like quitting drinking. You do have to some extent, like, change your life, change some of your friends, change your habits, change some of your hobbies. You have to, like, be able to change your identity to some extent.
Barney Whiter, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Over the Influence. If anybody wants to find out more about what you do, because obviously, you know, we've only just touched on it really for the last 10 minutes about the whole finance side of things, where can they find the info, Barney?
So I write a blog called The Escape Artist, which is www.theescapeartist.me. So not .com, not .co.uk, theescapeartist.me. So you can find me there.
Thank you very much. And if Ben wants to retire in 1,111 days, what does he need to do?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got much of a chance there, Barney.
Yeah.
Not enough. I think I need a minimum 10,000 days.
Start praying.
Yeah, great advice.
Find God.
To be honest, I've got a sausage dog downstairs that's barked through most of this recording. If anyone wants to buy a sausage dog, at least that's a start.
Barney, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, look, thank you for what you guys do. It's good work. It's really important work.